Well, good afternoon, everyone. We're glad that you're here. Hope you got some lunch, got a chance to catch up with some old friends, meet some new friends. If you're like me, the very first word you learned to spell was the very first Bible song you ever learned to sing, too. The B-I-B-L-E, yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the Word of God, the B-I-B-L-E, and after a while we learned to shout it and say Bible, as if that settled it. And that was the song that we sang, and that worked. As long as it worked. It worked until it didn't. And so for me, I began to, like many of you, encounter life and encounter the Scripture in different ways in a response to what I was experiencing as a human being and trying to make sense of all of it. And there were certain rules for engaging Scripture, and some of those were just not working for me. And I blame me, but I was struggling to make this all fit and to understand how my life of faith would work. And amazingly, as I got older, even though I worked at a church and later worked at Pepperdine and even led the Bible lectures, I began to wonder, you know, how does this all make sense? And so I was delighted to listen to a great podcast, Luke Norsworthy. He does Newsworthy with Norsworthy. If you're not a subscriber, you ought to be. And Luke had a great guest in Pete Enns. And that's when I first became introduced to Pete, understood a little bit about him, began to read his books, and then became a subscriber to his podcast, The Bible for Normal People. And I'm proud to say that it appears that I am a normal person because it's been very helpful to me. I'm delighted that Pete can be here from Eastern University. He is the Abram S. Clemens Professor of Biblical Studies at Eastern. He's also a member of the Society of Biblical Literature and a member of the Institute for Biblical Research. For many, he is a voice of reason and hope as we wrestle with this wonderful and confusing and challenging and complex thing we call the Bible. Pete says this. He says, I tell stories about this messy Bible and what it means to read it with both eyes open to its problems and challenges and to its promises and possibilities. So we think Pete is the perfect guest at the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. Would you please help me welcome Pete Enns?
Hi, everybody. Thank you for... How do people focus on this campus? That's what I want to know. This is the second time I've been here, and I just don't want to leave. I want to stay here for the rest of my life. Can I come live with you? I have a wife, three kids. Well, they're grown. They're out of the house. But I have seven animals. Can they come with me, too? Do you have room for that? Because I'd like to try that, actually. But no, it's wonderful to be back here at Pepperdine. It's been a few years since I've been here, but it's a beautiful experience. Yeah, let's talk about this, shall we? The sin of certainty. And let me explain what I mean by that. I don't mean that in the life of faith, if you feel certain, you're sinning or something ridiculous like that. What I mean is that we all get to that point in life where the faith doesn't make sense like it used to. Right? Unless if I'm the only one in this room, you can all leave. I'll just talk to myself for the next 45 minutes, right? But I think we all get to that point. If you've been trying to follow Jesus for more than about 45 minutes, you get to a point where it's like, I'm not so sure what I believe anymore. It used to be so clear, but it's not anymore. And the problem is that, you know, when you get to that point, we're often told, shh, don't say anything. Don't talk about it, you know, and sometimes church is the hardest place to actually be honest about your struggles with faith, right? Because you feel maybe ostracized, you feel less than, you feel like a sort of a second-class believer, and that's really a shame. So what I mean by the sin of certainty isn't when you feel certain. The sin of it all is when we don't accept that challenge that's coming our way, that challenge of faith, because sometimes when things aren't going right, there might be a very good reason for that, for our benefit, which we'll get into today a little bit. You sort of feel less than sometimes in church or talking to pastors, and I think that's a shame, in part because... Okay, I hope I get to use this thing right. Which button do I push? Oh, the worn-out one. Okay. The thing is, you know, sometimes we're told if you have a sense of God's absence or you're not sure what you believe in anymore, there's something wrong with you, you're broken, you have to be fixed. And the metaphor that's often used is,
your wall is crumbling and has to be put back together again. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but that's the language that I've heard very, very often. Because faith is like a wall. And if a couple of bricks fall out of place, what do? You cram those bricks back where they belong and you make the mortar stronger. The point, when you're feeling doubt or struggle or God's absence, the point is, whatever you do, get back to where you were before. Fix it and make it right. I don't think that's going to help. I think it's actually a message for us to sort of move further in the faith and not stay where we are, which is why metaphors like journey and pilgrimage have meant a lot to me over the past few years. I think of the faith as a journey that we're on, a pilgrimage that we're on that we can't always control. We don't know what's next. Right. So let me say this today. Feeling doubt or struggle with your faith is normal, it's biblical, and it's beneficial. It's all three of those things. There's nothing wrong with you. There's plenty of biblical precedent that if you're not familiar with some of these parts of the Bible, they're actually quite shocking, the way they talk about these struggles with faith and struggles with God. And it's also beneficial because I think these periods of doubt do something for us in our faith that nothing else can really do. All right? We tend not to grow in our faith when things are going well. What do you think of that? Do you think that's right? It's nice. Don't get me wrong. It's nice. I like when things are going well. But when they're not, you know, that sort of is the place for growth. Samuel Rutherford, a Puritan theologian, said, "Grace grows best in winter." But you have to embrace the winter. You have to let it be there. You can't explain it away. You can't put a heat lamp and make the snow melt away. You have to go through it. And we all have opportunities to go through it. So first of all, let's talk about normal, biblical, and beneficial. And I'm going to do the best I can not to be wordy like I usually am. And if you want to have some chance for interaction afterwards, we can certainly do that. If not today, I think in tomorrow's session, there'll be a little bit more time for that. And I'll just make sure to build it in. So, okay, first, normal. Okay, this is what did it to me. The bridge to Terabithia. And there's a little... Can I do this? Can I click this? If I click this, will it go? That's a hyperlink to YouTube. I don't know. Maybe if not, don't worry about it. Has anybody seen this movie? Yeah, or read the book? I haven't read the book, but I've seen the movie. Here's what was happening. I was on my way home from an academic conference from someplace actually in California years ago, and there was nothing to do on the flight on the way back. I was too tired to read. I was too tired to do anything, and let's watch a movie. And this is one of the ones they offered. It seemed the least boring of the other options, so I put it on. And it's this wonderful story about this guy here on the left. His name is Jesse. That's his little sister, Maybell. And that's the new kid on the block, Leslie. And Jesse and Maybell, brother and sister, they're from a pretty strong conservative Christian family, a loving Christian family, but very sort of conservative theologically. Leslie, who knows where she came from, she is nothing like that at all. She, like, her family listens to NPR. That's the kind of family you need to know right there, okay? She's sort of a tomboy, and she sort of is afraid of nothing. She has no fear in her life. Everything's an adventure. And if this video clip works, this is a scene of them in the back of the pickup truck. This is in Virginia. The back of the pickup truck coming home from church. They took Leslie to church one day. And this dialogue to me was very instructive. And let's see what happens. No, that's not right. Okay. I know what to do. No, I don't know what to do. Hold on. Stop making fun of me. It makes me really nervous up here. You people. Oh, wait. Will this work? No. I'll be with you in a minute. This will probably work. Unless the IT people want to help me. Why can't I just... Okay. I should just be able to click this right here. Go to page. This is promising. Okay. Hold on. The only thing is you can't see it now. I can see it. I'm going to enjoy this clip very much. If I don't get it up there... Sean, thank you. There's... Okay, now... Oh.
Okay. Is it going to be? Hold on. To the right? Here? There it is. Oh, there it is. There it is. Don't go anywhere because I have to get it back to the way it was before. So, all right. Okay. I think. Okay. Oh, gosh. All right. It is, isn't it? Okay. Everybody now? This better be good. That's all I can say. Okay.
I'm really glad I came. That whole Jesus thing, it's really interesting, isn't it?
It's not interesting. It's scary.
It's nailing holes through your hands. It's because we're all vile sinners. God made Jesus die.
You really think that's true?
It's in the Bible, Leslie.
You have to believe it, and you hate it. I don't have to believe it, and I think it's beautiful.
You gotta believe the Bible, Leslie.
Why?
Because if you don't believe in the Bible, God will damn you to hell when you die.
Wow, Maybelle. Where'd you hear that?
That's right, huh, Jess? God damns you to hell if you don't believe in the Bible.
I think so.
Well, I don't think so. I seriously do not think God goes around damning people to hell. He's too busy running all this.
All right, now we all have our little moments in life, and hold on. And my moment right now is getting this computer to do what I want it to do. Oh, this, I keep having to go this way.
I heard it was your birthday yesterday.
Okay.
Like it?
Here, you do it.
It must have cost a fortune.
What does it matter what it costs?
Here we go. Okay. Over here. We should be in the right place here. Here we go. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. You can go now. I think that was about it. Yeah, see, this is, I'm on an airplane to 30,000 feet, and I basically had this moment of faith struggle. I don't want to call it a faith crisis, but it was this, you ever get this feeling in the pit of your stomach that you've sort of been playing this game, you know, with God, and you're not really being honest. And this sort of happened to me because, see, Jesse and Maybelle's God was, that was sort of the community that I was a part of. That never quite made sense to me, but I never let the thoughts surface. Leslie's God, and you can agree or disagree, that's not the point here, right? But what Leslie said, that sort of hit me as like, that's actually what I believe. You got to believe in the Bible. If you don't believe in the Bible, God will damn you to hell. Isn't that right, Jesse? God will damn you to hell. I guess so. That sort of was my answer, right? I think Jesse's having the same moment that I had in this movie. Because then she says, I seriously do not think God goes around damning people to hell. He's too busy running all of this. Right? Now, again, your issue is your issue, my issue is my issue, but this was mine. At a time when I wasn't expecting, no, I didn't wake up that morning and saying, I think I'd like to be challenged in my faith today. Right? It just sort of happened when I'm not paying attention, I'm tired. I sort of had my guard down, you know, to make it all work. I had that guard down, and all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of something that I was not planning for. Also, I mean, you know, other things for me have made me think differently about God, have actually challenged my thinking about God in very deep, and I'm going to say very uncomfortable ways. You know, one up here, you know, I went to a research university for a PhD. I went to Harvard. It's just the same as all the other places. And the biggest challenge for me, people ask me, what was the biggest challenge for you studying there? And they expect me to say something like, well, I learned this really horrible thing in the classroom. And that's not it. The biggest challenge for me was meeting people who were so different from me, who thought differently, who had different assumptions about the nature of reality, who came from different parts of the world, who had no idea what I was about and what I was talking about. But they were also the nicest people I ever met.
so I couldn't demonize them. Right? They babysat my kids. There are Christians I would not let near my kids. I'm not kidding. You know. But it's just, you know, sometimes it's just meeting new people, right? If you're aware of your surroundings, you either, you know, have a new job or somebody shows up in your life you don't expect and they're very different from you. They believe very differently, but they're really just nice people. And I remember thinking, you know, in graduate school, saying, what does God think of them? Do I get a free pass because I'm like an insider to something? Or how does God feel about these people? Is God going to damn them to hell because of where they happen to have been born and what their experiences were, right? Or over here, this, in the Göbekli Tepe Temple in Turkey. This is a temple that was unearthed a few years ago. It's about 11,000 years old. All right, so what? Well, 11,000 years ago in Turkey, there was some sort of worshiping going on that required a temple. According to the Bible, the earth's about 6,000 years old. How long have people been around? How long have people been doing people things? And I read someplace on the internet, I'm sure it's true, but, you know, there's evidence of about 100,000 or so years ago of people building boats to get from one island to another. And I think of them as just, you know, what were they thinking? What were they like? You know, people have been around for such a long time doing things like this, and yet you have the biblical story where the earth's created about 6,000 years ago. Archaeologically speaking, about 6,000 years ago, the Sumerians invented beer. Right. You've got places like, you know, Stonehenge was how many years old? About 5,000 years old, roughly. Right. So it's just, my goodness gracious. Is it the biblical story? It doesn't explain things like that very well. It doesn't explain Stonehenge. It doesn't explain the Göbekli Tepe Temple, right? And then there's this, that thing up there, the Pillars of Creation. Anybody familiar with this? Ever see this before? All right, this is on one of my desktops on my computer, because it really, when I saw this, I just sort of stared at it for a while. I was probably avoiding something, but I was staring at it anyway, contemplating. And it's, I want to get the figures right here. It's 7,000 light years from Earth. Which isn't very far, folks, and from space points of view, right? I mean, but it's 7,000 light years from Earth. Travel the speed of light. It takes you 7,000 years to get there. And those pillars are all about 4 light years tall. And I know, see, Psalm 19 says things like, the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. And I'm like, no, they pretty much scare the daylights out of me. Right? That's Blaise Pascal, a philosopher, said, the infinite spaces, the infinite darkness of the spaces frightens me. Because who are we? What significance do we have? If you're familiar with Carl Sagan and that show Cosmos, which was redone about, 3 years ago by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and there's a very moving soliloquy that was redone for that Carl Sagan gave in the original version, which was like 1980, called The Pale Blue Dot. Has anybody ever heard that soliloquy? It's actually beautiful. It's very moving. But he says that the earth is a speck of dust suspended in a sunbeam because of the gravitational pull. Not a bad way of putting it. We're so small, we're so insignificant, and okay, what am I doing here? I'm minding my own business watching a movie. I meet new people. I'm looking on the internet. I find things like this. I'm aware of some historical and scientific discoveries. All these things cause us to have to rethink what we think about God, about the nature of life, and all that. And it's normal. It's, you have to really isolate yourself not to be in conversation with things like this. And it's really difficult. So it's normal, right? we're not broken. If you look at this and you say, I used to think things like this and it was so simple, now I'm not so sure anymore. When you're at that point, you're not in an abnormal place in life, even if people tell you that you are. If you have people in your life telling you that, you need new friends or a new husband or wife, but I can't say that. That's not my place, right? It's normal. It's also biblical. How'd that picture get in there? No, this is why. These are my three grown children. Guess which one doesn't want his picture taken? That's Eric on the left. He is now 29. This was taken last year. My daughter, Elizabeth, she's in the middle. And if you've read The Sin of Certainty, by the way, I'm not... Who's read The Sin of Certainty? You may remember I tell a little bit about my daughter, Liz. I'm not one of these people that says, you need to read my book. You need to buy it. I don't care if you read it or not, frankly. Just give the copies away. I just don't care. But that's my daughter, Liz. I'll get to her in a second. And this is my daughter, Sophie, on the end. She is the youngest. She'll be 24 in a month. And this is going to be hard, especially those of you who are parents with fat children. You're not going to believe this. This is hard for me to admit in public. But when my daughter, Sophie, was 16, I'm glad you're sitting down because this is really hard. She did not worship the ground that I walked on. And all the parents are like, yeah. She was just like really mean at me all the time. And I don't know what I did. You know, I didn't do anything. She didn't friend me on Facebook. And then I pestered her and she did friend me. And then she unfriended me. So I'm like, this is like the most horrible thing. My daughter hates my guts. So one day, she's coming out of her bedroom. I'm coming out of mine sort of at the same time. And I see her, like we can't avoid her anymore. I said, Sophie, what's going on here? Just tell me what's happening. And she said, I don't like you. And then walked down the steps. So I'm like, I'm the worst father ever in the history of humanity. No daughter has ever said this to her father. It's just me. You know, so but I was, remember then, right after that, I mentioned this to a friend of mine who'd been through this years earlier. Told him what happened. He said, good for you. So what do you mean, good for me? And he said, think about it. Sophie trusts you enough to tell you what she actually thinks without the threat of you rejecting her. So he said, great job parenting. I'm like, all right. from 0 to 60 like that, right? So, but you see, I mean, to me, this is that's a beautiful reminder of, I think, how the Bible works. The Bible is brutally honest about struggles with faith, about any relationship that you're in, right? If you don't have a foundation of some honesty, that's just a facade. You don't actually have a relationship. And biblical writers are very, very upfront about the kinds of things that they feel free to say in God's face. And you know, one of those is up here on the right, Psalms of Lament. Right, there are about 150 psalms, and about half of them, something's going wrong. Right. And I want to think about that for a second. Those doors are locked, right? I'm going to bore you for about 10 seconds here, right? The book of Psalms, as we know it today, was not really completed until probably around the time of Jesus. There are different versions of what we call the Psalter, different versions of the Psalter running around. And it wasn't really finalized until the time of Jesus. No, who cares about that? Well, here's the who cares part. They kept these psalms in there. There was an intentional editing process. They kept together these psalms of lament. Why? Because they are legitimate expressions of people of faith. You don't let go of them. You don't. The Bible is so unsanitized. It is so earthy and it is so real. That's why the more I read it, it's just like, don't say that. Don't you know how we're going to be taking this literally? Like, just don't do that. But so Psalms of Lament, and you know, for example, one of my favorite psalms is Psalm 44, which goes basically like this. Oh Lord, remember the good old days when you fought battles for us and we had victories and we won. Yeah, sure wish we could have those old days back again, because right now we're getting beaten the daylights out of us by our enemies. and we haven't done anything. So where are you? Yeah, those old days were real great to get back here. How about waking up? That's what the psalmist says towards the end. Wake up. Awaken. It sounds nicer when you say awaken than wake up, but it means the same thing, right? You're sleeping. Now, how many people in their lives have ever experienced God sleeping on them when they need God to show up now? We're not alone. Psalm 73 is a great psalm. Lord, I know how this works. You bless the righteous and you punish the wicked. I've read the brochure. I know how this is supposed to work. But as for me, my feet had almost slipped. I had nearly lost my foothold. I almost caved in. Why? Because I saw the prosperity of the wicked. The wicked are prospering. The righteous, like me, and it's not fake for somebody in the Psalms to call themselves righteous. It means basically you're being a good Israelite and you're following the things you're supposed to do. You're not maligning other people. You're not taking advantage of people, stuff like that. Right? I'm a righteous person and I'm not sleeping at night. And I've got pains and I don't know what to do. At one point, just what I think is the center of the Psalm, he says, if I had spoken thus, he says, if I had spoken in this way, I would have betrayed your children. And I sort of think of him as sort of like an ancient religious leader, a pastor, if you will. If I had talked about this, I would have betrayed your children. I can't talk about it because of the responsibility I have to people around me. I think that's actually wrong. I think he should have talked about it. But actually, he's writing it down. Of course he's talking about it. And it's in the Bible. So we're all seeing it anyway, right? But if I had spoken thus, I would have betrayed your children. But when I tried to keep it in, it was oppressive to me. I can't talk about it. I can't keep it in. I don't know what to do. And so the next scene has him going to the temple to offer sacrifices to God. I think it's a beautiful picture. What's he doing? He's getting in God's face saying, I don't know what to do. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to you directly. When my son Eric, when he was six, he had his own little faith crisis when we were talking about the serpent story. And he wasn't impressed with that story at all because animals don't talk. That's why. Right? And we went through with that a little bit, and it was clear to me that he was having a faith crisis because I can't believe this because I watch cartoons every day and animals talk there and that's not real, so how can this be real? Right, and this is one of the few times I actually got something right as a parent. I actually told Eric, I said, tell God that. Don't tell me. I mean, you can tell me, but don't feel like that's a barrier to you, to God, to say, I'm having trouble with this. You know, what a wonderful way we could live as Christians if we could have that kind of honesty with God, right? Just like these psalms do. Psalm 88, another one of my favorite psalms. The most depressing, like, 18 verses in the entire Bible. Everything's going wrong. Everything is dark. Everything is miserable. And it's God's fault. And at the end, he says, darkness is my only companion. The only companion I have is the darkness in which I find myself. End of psalm. Don't try to fix it. Write to Psalm 89. This is depicted over here. The end of Judah, which is destroyed by the Babylonians. The psalm goes something like this. Psalm 89. Oh Lord, you, first of all, you're just the most awesome thing ever. Okay? Why are you awesome? Because you're almighty. You created the cosmos. You can do anything. And you are so trustworthy. We can trust everything that comes out of your mouth. You are so almighty and you are so trustworthy. Thank you so much. By the way, have we pointed out lately how awesome you are, that you're trustworthy and that you're almighty? And it goes on like this for like 30 verses, right? And, you know, here's the thing. You made this amazing promise to us. You made this promise that Jerusalem would last forever. And you would never cease having a son of David sitting on the throne in Jerusalem. That would always be the case forever. So thank you for being almighty and for making promises that will never fail. Question, Lord, Can we talk about the exile to Babylon for a minute? What happened there? The Babylonians came. The last king on the throne of the south, Zedekiah, he was blinded and taken away to Babylon, but not before his sons were killed in front of him, thus, in effect, ending the Davidic line and going into exile. Psalm 89 basically calls God a liar. You said this would happen and it's not. Prove yourself. Prove yourself as faithful because I don't see it right now. You feel like telling this guy, could you just tone it down a little bit? Because you know, people are listening and people are reading this in 2,000, 3,000 years from now. Don't do that. But you know, that's the way it is in life of faith. You just have to be honest. And I think the Bible models that. Job is another great book. You know, I could talk about that for hours, but give me like 30 seconds. Job is a story. The book basically goes like this. Job is suffering. And his friends say, what? What did you do to deserve this? And Job says, nothing. And his friends say, yes, you did. And Job says, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yeah, you did. For like 40 chapters, it goes on like that. This back and forth dialogue, which is intricate and theologically deep, and I'm not doing it justice, right? But here's the thing. Where do Job's friends get the idea from? Deuteronomy, yeah, and maybe Proverbs, sort of, but definitely Psalm 1, too, right? There are two types of people in the world. Those who meditate on the law day and night, and those who are wicked. And those who meditate on the law, who are righteous, are rewarded. Those who are the opposite, they get punished. Right? So Job says, I didn't do anything. And his friends say, yeah, you did. Because his friends are actually good biblical theologians. They're actually following the biblical idea. And at the end of the book, if you know how Deuteronomy ends, it ends sort of weird, like he gets more kids. So when is that a benefit? I don't know. But so, you know, it ends with God saying to one of Job's friends, you have not spoken of me justly as my servant Job has. Right? Now, why is that so striking? Because the Bible, and we can get into if there was even a Bible at this time, but leave that to the side for now. The biblical message, one of the dominant biblical messages is God punishes the wicked, right? And he rewards the righteous. Here, Job is punished, but he's not wicked, and God says that he's right. So you can't cage God in, so to speak, even in a biblical text. Maybe God has the freedom to move beyond that. Right? But the main point here is Job is in a state of crisis, because he's read the brochure too. He knows how it's supposed to work. But he says, but I'm not going to give in on this. I didn't do anything. So, if you're in a period of struggling with faith, don't let somebody quote Bible verses at you about why you shouldn't be that way. Just say the book of Psalms, Ecclesiastes, and Job, and you're pretty much covered. Of examples of deep struggling with their faith. And, you know, by the way, this is a small commercial for why the Old Testament is worth your while. As a Christian, it is long. It does sort of tend to go on and on, but still, there's something there of great value, right? In the New Testament, the span of time is pretty narrow. I'm going to say, let's say for argument's sake, about 50, 60, 70 years. And the tone of the New Testament is very triumphant. Jesus has come. The end is near. Don't get married. Just wait. Jesus is coming back. It's a triumphant note that's struck in the New Testament. The Old Testament isn't like that because it goes on for hundreds and hundreds of years and a millennium and even longer. Plenty of time for things to go wrong. See, we today, what year is this, 2017? Jesus was born probably in the year 4 BC. Don't make me explain that, but that's probably true. So it's over 2,000 years we've been doing this. Plenty of chance for things to go wrong. Plenty of things for us to sort of doubt and say, it's hard to hold on like this. Show us something, throw us a bone to make it all seem like this makes sense. And our partners are people like Job or the book of Ecclesiastes or these lament psalms. And I think it's great that they're in the Bible. Not that anybody asked me, but I think they're great. Okay, so it's biblical, it's normal, and it's also beneficial. And this is one of my favorite stories, which I tell every chance I get, about Mother Teresa up there on the right. And years ago, I was just at home, and I was going through my own stuff, trying to process just the nature of my faith, and there's a long story behind that. But, you know, I stumbled on this story on the internet about Mother Teresa and this guy on the right, John Kavanaugh. John Kavanaugh was a philosopher at St. Louis University. He just died a couple of years ago, who was having his own crisis of faith. So he went to Calcutta to visit Mother Teresa because he figures she'll have the answer. She'll know what to do. Right? So he shows up and she says to him, "Well, it's good to meet you. What can I do for you?" And he says, "You can pray for me." And he goes, "How can I pray for you?" He says, "Pray that I have clarity." Because that was his issue. He was loss of clarity about himself and his faith and his life. He just was losing it, midlife, right? Losing it. And so I just pray that I have clarity. And she said, "I will not do that." And he's like, "I wasted a plane ticket. You know, why not?" And she said, "Because clarity is the last thing you are clinging to and must let go of." And when I read that, again, in my own moment, we all have our moments, right, where things sort of hit us certain ways. This might not hit me today exactly the same way, but it did hit me then. I remember thinking to myself, I'm doing this wrong. I'm trying to hold on to a sense of certainty, and I think God's job is to give me clarity. And if I don't have that clarity, there's something wrong with me. And, you know, I need to sort of fix this as quickly as possible. And seeing this story on the internet was it was impactful for me. I tell my college students, I say, what really turned me around is I met this wonderful woman on the internet. Yeah, they don't laugh either. I think it's really funny anyway. But I say, but it's Mother Teresa. Look at her. So anyway, I put up here St. John of the Cross, the dark night of the soul, and there's a whole history behind that of where you sometimes see God in the darkness differently than you would in the light, right? And so she said, you know, to John Kavanaugh, clarity is the last thing you're clinging to and must let go of. And then he said to her, he said, "Well, you seem to have tons of clarity." And at that point, she just laughed. She just laughed. She says, "Clarity? I've never had clarity a day in my life. But what I've had is trust. So I will pray that you trust God." That was a new idea for me, folks. A type A male intellectual German. It's like, I'm done. I was like, this Christian faith is not meant for people like me, right? But I heard that and I said, my goodness gracious, what a radical idea to trust God, to commit yourself to trust God, even if you don't know what that looks like, even if you don't know where that's going to lead you. Rather than saying, I have to know how this is going to work out first. Right? And I think it's a wonderful story that, like I said, means a lot to me. And it's sort of the light bulb just sort of went off there for a second. And I'm thankful for that moment. I still don't quite understand how that works, but that's sort of the point. You know, the old theologians used to say faith seeking understanding. It's not understanding first and then faith. It's faith first and then seeking understanding. One more quick story here. This refers now to my middle daughter, Elizabeth. And as I tell this story, and with her permission, by the way, she's now 26. She's been married for about 2.5 years. She's going to have a baby, actually, in the fall. So. And if you know her, and none of you do, you know her story, it's like, okay, this is pretty cool with this, how this turned out. And with her permission, you know, I'm able to talk a little bit about her. It's her story, it's not mine. But basically, from the age of 8, she began suffering debilitating anxiety and panic attacks and depression all at the same time, which happens, you know, a lot, actually. It's not just my daughter. I didn't know that at the time. I thought we were like bad parents again, you know. But school refusal and just couldn't do anything. And then, long story short, when she was about 16, my wife Sue and I, we made the very difficult decision, she can't stay here. And people were advising us, she's got to leave, you got to send her someplace where she can sort of unplug from the family system. And she wound up going to Arizona. Actually, I live, Liz's house is in southeastern Pennsylvania. She went to a wilderness program. Anybody familiar with wilderness programs here, right? It's sort of where you unplug and you live outside. Literally, you don't go inside at all. And she was there for 2 months. And then from there, she went to Mayer, Arizona, a therapeutic boarding school, which was one of the most healing places I've ever been to in my life. More than many churches. I'm going to say more than most churches I've been to in my life. Because there she wasn't told she's a vile sinner and God's really angry with you unless you get it right. She was told you're of infinite worth. Right? We don't hear that very often in churches, but that's another talk. Anyway, when she was in Clayton, Georgia in this two-month wilderness program, we knew that she had to go away afterwards. And I said, okay, Lord, here's the deal. We'll send her someplace. But it's got to be close by. I have to be able to visit or call her anytime I want to. And I want her to be co-ed because I want her to have a normal high school experience. So she went to an all-girls school in Arizona. Might as well be Hawaii as far as I was concerned. I had to find Arizona on a map. I'm an East Coaster, right? And no, you could not visit her and call her anytime you wanted. You had a five-minute phone call once a week. The whole point is to unplug for a certain amount of time, and then you sort of reunite as a family. And it was a beautiful time. And she was out in the desert like this, and it was healing. But there's one story here that I tell in the book, and I'd like to tell again because, like I said, it was one of these things that just meant something to me that alerted me to how I just don't control the universe. I don't control God. I don't control my life. I don't have a choice. Control is an illusion. You have to trust God or not trust God. That's a decision we have to make. And it was about a month before she wound up going to Clayton, about a month before she started leaving home. We knew she'd be going someplace she knew. And she said, Dad, when you go out to Arizona, I was out there because my son's baseball team played every spring. Their college team played, so I used to go. And that was the beginning of my liturgical year, basically, spring training and baseball. But so I went out there, and Liz said, you know, Dad, when you're out there, could you get me a Livestrong bracelet? This is before Lance Armstrong became a bad person, okay? But back then, and I said, you know, sure, Liz, I'd love to get you one. Because she knew she was going to go someplace, and she wanted something to hold on to remind her to be strong. Sure, Liz, I'll go find you one. So I would go to the malls and stuff. I couldn't find a Livestrong bracelet anywhere. And they were a thing back then. Like, everybody had Livestrong bracelets. I couldn't find one anywhere. So I sort of, like, midweek, I sort of gave up, and I was about to call her and say, I can't really find one. But then we went to a barbecue. One of the alums lives out in Arizona, in the Phoenix area, and invites the team and their parents over and the coaches for this huge barbecue. And it's just a beautiful house and all kind of stuff. And his name is John, and I struck up a conversation with John as he was cooking hamburgers, and he's flipping hamburgers and that kind of stuff. And he reaches out his arm to flip a hamburger, and there's a Livestrong bracelet on his wrist. And I remember thinking to myself, I bet you he knows where I can get one. But then another question popped into my head was, maybe he has one to give you. But I suppressed that question because it was stupid. I pushed it down, right? And all I said to John was, oh, John, I hear you have a Livestrong bracelet. I see you have a Livestrong bracelet. And he goes, yeah, I have a bag of them in my closet. Would you like some? And I don't remember what happened after that. But for me, it's one of like three or four God moments that I can locate in my life where I had to step back. I had to go someplace. I just started crying on a lawn chair. And I said, okay, I get it. I don't have to worry as much. I don't have to obsess. I can be concerned, and I can do the right thing. I can make wise decisions, but maybe I don't control this as much as I think I do. Right? Maybe God is actually there. Who knew? right? Now, I know that other people have had experiences where God doesn't show up like that. I can't minimize that, but I actually can't speak into that. I can just speak into my experience that I had. And I think back, and I still get emotional thinking about that, because it's like, this is still a very powerful thing that happened that made me realize there is actually mystery in the universe. We can't control. We can't hold on. You're going to have periods of uncertainty intellectually, aren't we? All right. That's natural. We have experiences. We have things that blow our world apart. In the midst of that, you can still make the choice. As a friend of mine said to me years ago, he said, Pete, every day you have a choice. You can choose to trust or to fear. What are you going to do every single day? So I'm trying to trust every day. I'm trying to hold on to that momentum, so to speak, right? And not thinking that you have to hold on and keep all of life clear or else you're doing something wrong. I actually think these kinds of moments are sacred journeys. Right? Let me end with this. It's quarter after. I'll just end with this. Of my three kids, Liz is the most spiritually active, which is fun. My other kids are great, but she's the most spiritually active. I think it's because of experiences like this, because she suffered in ways that others haven't. And she's had to herself make the decision, I don't know how I can face another day. Do I trust God or do I not do that? And I think it's sort of helped her, made her stronger. Okay, we're going to stop there. Do we just need to stop completely? It's 2:15. Is anybody running this? Are you running this, Rick, or am I running this? How does this work at Pepperdine?
Yes,
this California thing. What happens out here?
Yeah.
I'm happy if for a couple minutes, and I know people have places to go, but then tomorrow... Okay. Any comments or questions or anything, just for maybe a couple minutes? Yes.
In the book, you talk about obviously uncertainty and trusting God.
Mm-hmm.
You repeat this phrase over and over again that it's still important that you do know, that you know about God. Can you talk about that a little bit? That cut out line between handing over that need to know.
Right. So I think knowing and our rational capabilities are part of what make us human. I just don't think they run the show all the time. Right? So it's, you know, I have experiences and people have spiritual experiences they can't explain. That doesn't make them not real. They're just not filtered through our rational capabilities. So knowing is inevitable, I think. And I think it's also important to know something about Jesus, about God, about the biblical story. Right? I think those things are very, very important. But knowledge comes and goes, right? We can always choose to trust if we want to, right? So I think it's a matter of, I mean, it sounds simplistic, maybe a matter of priorities more than one or the other. I know too many Christians who discount the emotional and experiential life entirely when they talk about their faith. That's a huge, you're just setting yourself up for a big problem there, I think. Yeah. Anybody else? No, I'm fine. We can just... They have places to go, too. I don't. Not till tomorrow, I guess. So anyway. But thank you, people. I appreciate you coming very much. Thank you.